From the Vaults, audio from Edmonton's past.
This recording consists of an interview of Maisie Hamilton conducted by David Leonard on August 30th, 1977. This material was originally recorded on a 5-inch open reel tape and was digitized by an archivist on August 24th, 2020.
This interview is being conducted on the 30th of August, 1977, with Miss Maisie Hamilton, a longtime resident of Edmonton. Now, Miss Hamilton, perhaps we could begin by having you recount a bit of your childhood and when you moved to the West and Edmonton.
Well, I was born in England, in Liverpool, and in 1913, we came direct from Liverpool to Edmonton. It was a very strange trip. All the way across the prairies, my father would say to my mother, "I hope Molly, who was my aunt, hasn't got a wooden house. I don't think I could live in a wooden house. We've always had brick or stone houses." But when we came here, it was a wooden house. We came into Edmonton from Calgary on the first regular passenger train from Calgary over the high-level bridge. It wasn't the first train. There'd been many work trains gone over, and in the morning of the 19th of June, the bridge was opened with the official train, with the official party, arriving in Edmonton about 12 o'clock, and we came in at 4 in the afternoon. And all the way up from Calgary, people were saying, "Do you think we've crossed the bridge? Do you think we've crossed the bridge?"
So you had no foreknowledge then, if you would.
No. We didn't know about the bridge, you see, and I thought Canada must be a very funny country if you didn't know where the train was going.
Yes.
We got off at a makeshift station just north of 97th Avenue, which in those days was called Hardesty. Mm-hmm. It was a little rough shack, because it was temporary, with a little rough wooden station. Oh. And it didn't seem very much of a place to start a new life.
Yeah. The place to start in town, isn't it?
That's it. It was still decorated with the bunting for the official party, but as leaving the station, people rolling up the bunting and taking it off for another occasion.
The station itself is very primitive, and this is the first place you stopped.
Yeah.
And perhaps the first, you saw another number of buildings on the way in, but did you know that this was just a temporary station waiting for...
I don't think so. I think it was all just part of the new world, the new land.
Uh-huh. But you mentioned it was made of wood.
Wood.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier a bit of apprehension about having to live in a wooden house.
So Father was very perturbed about having to live in a wooden house.
Uh-huh.
He'd never lived in a wooden house. It was always stone or brick.
Uh-huh.
And of course, crossing the prairies, most of the houses were logs, but there were the odd wooden house.
Right. So it seemed a bit harsh.
It was going to sound, it seemed very harsh.
So when you first arrived, did you have a house waiting for you, or did you...
Yes, we stayed with my aunt. And then Father had to go east on business with the three children, myself and my two brothers. One was George Hamilton, and the other one was Winslow Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
Winslow was about 2, and we stayed with my aunt for some months, and Father had to go east on business. I'm not sure why. And Mother was left to buy a house.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the conditions in 1913 were just like the conditions of today, 1977. Houses were very hard to get.
That's great population.
It was just at the end of the population explosion. After us, the Depression came, or the boom, sank, whatever they called it in those days.
Yeah.
And Mother was looking for a big house because there were five of us in the family and a maid. And she searched very diligently. And there was one house she was described, and she thought it would be very good, very nice house. But she insisted on the real estate man driving her to the school when the children came out, because she wanted to see the type of children we would be associating with.
Uh-huh.
And she didn't like it. They weren't the kind we were used to.
Uh-huh.
But we finally got a house that was not quite finished on 3rd Street, which is now 103rd,
uh-huh.
halfway down, 2.5 blocks from Jasper, uh-huh. halfway down the hill. And we had it finished.
And that house is still standing today.
It's still standing. I lived in it until the 30th of June, 1977, 63 years in one house,
mm-hmm.
which is almost a record, I think.
Yes, it would be close.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you mentioned your father had gone back east. What sort of business was he in?
He was an importer. He was an importer in England.
Uh-huh.
And he came out with the idea of being an importer here. A representative or a contact with Horace Cottons of Lancashire, Scottish Tweed, a linen factory in Ulster or Northern Ireland,
uh-huh.
and with some of the rather famous English foods that were used to be put up to be sent to the colonies,
uh-huh.
India, Africa, Australia.
Uh-huh.
That's what he yes. was going to
was
do.
Was he able to do a fairly good business?
He did uh-huh. until the war came. Then of course we couldn't get anything out after the war came.
Yes. But he maintained his.
Maintained it as long as he could, and then mm-hmm. he just developed into a general store after that.
Mm-hmm. I see. Now, how old were you when you?
10.
You were 10 at the time.
I was 10.
So you enrolled in school.
Yeah, I went to Mackay Avenue School.
Mackay Avenue School. Can you tell me a little bit about the difference between the education system out here in those days and what you experienced in England?
Well, I had gone to a school in England. Rose Street College for the Daughters of Gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
No, yes, that was it, for the Daughters of Gentlemen. Like most of the big English schools, it was operated by the church, although the fees were very high. And it was a day school, it was not a boarding school.
Mm-hmm.
The classes were very small. I think in the transition period into the class in which I went just before we left, there was no class more than 12. If a class got to be 12 or 13, it was divided 7 and 6. So it was rather shocking to be dumped into a schoolroom with about 30 children, boys and girls.
Of all social and economic classes
as well. It was Mackay Avenue, and they were all practically the same social standing.
Class. I see, yes. Uh-huh.
There were very, very, very poor children, uh-huh. because there was no poor people in that area.
Right. I guess when you moved to that area, it was something of an experiment, too. There was very little buildings down on the hill.
No, we were the last house that was built. South on our side of the street. There were a few more houses on the other side that
uh-huh.
went down to the corner of what was then Hardesty.
Uh-huh.
But ours was the only one on the most southern one on our side of the street, at the east side of the street.
Mm-hmm.
And from us and the river, 3 or 4 blocks away, were no houses at all. It was just a clear view.
So people weren't really expecting the city to expand this way so much as it's towards the east?
West.
To the west?
To the west, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. the Third Street Hill was still undeveloped, and we used to ski on it, sleigh on it, and go right downhill almost to the railroad tracks that ran from the low-level bridge to the powerhouse.
Did it function as a bit of a ski jump at this time as well?
No, it was just a child's playground. It was not a skier. The real ski, that was exactly where it is still. The ski jump.
It was built about this time too, wasn't it?
It was built then. And they had some competitions, some championships, and a great many Norwegians and Scandinavians had come from Camrose district to take part in that. I remember it took part in took place one warm, sunny Sunday afternoon that winter.
Yeah. I suppose the winters out here were a very traumatic experience for you when you first experienced them.
That winter wasn't bad. We didn't have snow until Christmas Eve, which was quite a disappointment. We expected to be tramping through snow all winter. We had a slight snowstorm in the beginning of October, and then there was no snow. It was a beautiful fall. Mm-hmm. It was a beautiful fall. The golden leaves remained on the trees for a long, long time because there was no wind. Mm-hmm. And then the snow came at Christmas, and we were able to wear our warm English clothes for the winter. Of heavy boots and things of that kind.
What was the social life like in the early years? The city had grown so greatly in the previous decade that I'm sure there are so many different cultures, varieties here thrown together virtually. Were there great public events, or did different ethnic groups more or less coalesce amongst each other?
No, there was nothing as we call ethnic groups nowadays. The few ethnic people who were in the town were maids, or else the men were laborers or people like that. They had no impact at that time.
I see. Not in the town itself. They were generally settled in the outside area.
Because they were homesteaded in the outside area.
That's right.
And when the girls used to come in the fall and work, and when the harvest was over and the work was finished in the farm, they came in and earned a bit of money. The men did the same thing. Mm-hmm. But there was no contact, as far as I know. There were no children in the school, at Mackay School, of that type at all.
That spoke a foreign language?
No, it was all. Then there was a circle. I think they were known as the French Elite. And they were west of 9th Street, probably about 12th and 13th Street. And until a few years ago, those two or three blocks looked like France. The houses had a French atmosphere.
Yeah.
But they've been renovated and changed, and we've lost a lot.
Yes. Some of the individuals in the French elite, I suppose, Picard, Leroux,
Côté. Côté became a senator.
Yeah, John Côté.
Judge Dubuque.
Did you get to know any of them personally?
Well, they went to the separate school, and I went to the public school. But we did have a slight contact through our friends. Mm-hmm. I remember going home with one of my school friends. It might have been Helen Boyle, I don't remember. And the lady was entertaining two French ladies for tea, and they were sitting in the drawing room. Very old parlor, they called it, I think. Very dignified, and we were asked to come in and be introduced. And I walked away thinking I'd reached an exotic night, that I had never been in such close contact with foreign ladies before. They were very charming women, and I'd forgotten all about them until I was in Montreal a couple of years ago, and I saw two ladies at a concert, and it took me back to the delightful women.
Mm-hmm.
I'd forgotten who they were, but they were. It was a very, very dignified life.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were the UE loyalists. They had their own little circle.
Mm-hmm. Was this circle apart from other British settlers in general, or other British Edmontonians in general? Were they more or less an elite?
Well, I think they were the small population that there was mingled, but they had these two or three little sections of their own.
Uh-huh. Well, the UEO group then, who was prominent in that circle?
There was Mrs. Nichols. Her father was, her husband had been a doctor. He was dead by now. No, he wasn't. He was alive then. Mrs. Saunders, Colonel Saunders' wife. It has nothing to do with the chicken season.
Nothing to do with the chicken.
No. You know quite a few of them.
The McDougals, the Seacords, weren't involved.
Well, they were so above everybody else that
they
reigned. without trying to.
Is that right?
Yes. They were above all these little smaller groups, although the Seacords were UE loyalists.
Yes, they had been.
They were UE loyalists. McDougals weren't.
No.
No, the Oliver's.
Did you know the Seacords at all?
Oh, very well.
Mm-hmm.
They're some of my best friends.
Richard Seacord is the epitome of the rugged individual,
yeah.
Western,
yeah.
Businessman. What sort of a man was he?
Who?
Richard Senior.
Richard Senior. Well, I scarcely knew him, and we were afraid of him. I think he had a very loud voice.
Uh-huh.
But we were all afraid of him.
Did you know John A. McDougall at all?
Yes.
What sort of man was he?
He was a very gentlemanly-looking man. You might think he was a scholar or a
mm-hmm.
professor rather than a businessman.
Mm-hmm. Well, he did have a good sense of art, I believe.
Yes, he did.
Paintings, I believe he was.
And his wife was a very charming little lady.
Uh-huh.
One day my father met Mrs. McDougall and the daughter Alice on the street, and my father, who was a very proper little man, had an armful of clothes. He was a little embarrassed, and he explained to them that I didn't want to do that. He explained to them that he'd heard of a family on a homestead that had been burnt out. And he'd been to all the people that he knew who had children and had gathered up as many clothes as he could. This family had about 8 or 9 children.
Mm-hmm.
And they went on uptown, and Father came home. And about an hour later, Jimmy McDougall, one of the sons, came down with a shoebox, saying that his mother remembered how hard it was to be on the prairies with out needles and thread and necessary things.
Mm-hmm.
And the shoebox was filled. There were 2 bars of Lifebuoy soap and 2 bars of Sunlight soap. There was no nonsense about it. And
mm-hmm.
the rest of the box was filled with darning wool, needles, thread, buttons, and things of that sort. It was a very It's something that I always like to remember about Mrs. McDougall.
Mm-hmm.
Her memory still was good for her for the early days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How about some of the other prominent Edmontonians that you recall? Any of that stick out in your mind?
I remember Judge Boyle, although at that time, when I first remember him, he was the Minister of Education. He then became the Attorney General in the old Liberal, and was defeated, or the government was defeated, the Liberal government was defeated by the UFA in about 1922. And he was then appointed the Chief Justice of Alberta, and he was the first local product to sit on the bench. I know recently somebody else died and they claimed he was, but he wasn't. It was Judge Boyle was the first. He'd come out as a school teacher, been articled to a lawyer, and then went practiced, and then was in the government, and then was appointed the Chief Justice of Alberta, the first of all over province. Others had all been from England or Ontario, mostly from Oxford or Hall in Ontario.
Was your father active in any political organization, or What social crowd did he mix with in this town?
Well, it seemed to me he mixed with everybody. He seemed to know everybody, and he was a conservative, and conservatives were very, very scared.
That's right, yes.
So that he wasn't invited to the big Liberal dues, which nearly everybody was.
Yes.
But he was. My mother was a very vibrant woman. She was a musician. She seemed to be in the forefront of most of the, or at least halfway up, in all the arts movements of thought.
Did she belong to the any of the prominent women's organizations?
She belonged to the IODE.
IODE?
Oh, not WCT.
No.
She belonged to the IODE. She was regent of Westward Ho for 11 years. She was belonged to the Women's Canadian Club. She started, she and a couple of her friends, started the Registered Music Teachers Association. She was president of the Women's Musical Club. And I can't think of all the other things she was.
Yes. Was the IODE very strong?
It was very strong.
Uh-huh.
It was extremely strong. There was one chapter, the Westward Ho, started, I think, about 1900, 1901. During the Boer War, anyway. It was rather small, 10 or 12 people, and you had to be invited. And a great many other people thought they'd like to be invited, but they weren't. And some of them started their arrival chapter, Beaver House.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Did they intermix at all?
Oh, yes, yes. But Westward Ho was something above the elite. And then one time, Mother was invited to join. And then she was one of the giddy young things that were the older members. Not actually descendants of the Fathers of Confederation and Yuri Loyalists, but daughters or granddaughters or granddaughters-in-law of the Fathers of Confederation. Two or three of the MacDougalls, the old missionaries, Mrs. Harrison Young, and Mrs. Harrison, what are the other two? Mrs. Hardesty. They belonged. Well, they were older than Mother, and they were rather severe, I think, on the whole. And then Mother was asked to join, and she was one of the giddy young things, and several of the others who were joined at about that time were the giddy young things. And then years later, Mother became regent, and another group of giddy young things were invited to join. They joined over the years. And then, many years later, I was invited by the giddy young things of Mother's era, and I was a giddy young thing of a new era. But unfortunately, they didn't keep opening the doors. Uh-huh. And finally, there were just two or three young ones, and the old ones wanted to close it down. So it came, which is very sad. It had been running for nearly 50 years. This is all in some place else, I know. But in the early days, before Mother's time, they bought an ambulance. You see, when people were sick and had to go to the hospital, there was no way of taking them unless they got a dray or a buggy and took them. So the Westwood Hall bought an ambulance. And he was kept in the fire hall on 4th Street. Mm-hmm. And they used the horses in the fire hall when it was called out. I presume it was one of the firemen who drove it. I don't know that. But the fire horses were trained to go furiously.
Yeah.
And they put the poor patient in, and the horses went rushing down the mud-rutted streets, you see, because the patient's more than seen, boom. So then they bought a pair of very quiet horses, and the firemen still looked out.
What other activities do the IODE specialize in these days?
Well, they were in practically everything. They did a great many things that they thought should be done. Now, after the First World War, they thought, because they were all intensely patriotic and intensely British, they started a fund to buy a memorial. And they had about $4,000. And the Legion, I think, had about $2,000. And somebody got the bright idea that this money should be spent. Mind you, it was getting around 1930s by this time, I think. And the journal asked for ideas, and there were some horrible ideas. They wanted to be made a comfort station, and it upset the ladies and the Canadian Legion very much. So they got very busy, and Mother was in Victoria, and she found out where Calgary had got their memorial. And she and I went out to see this, and we talked business with them. And then when she came back, she put her cards on the table. This was going to cost this much and that much, and it should be done. They couldn't make it as elaborate as Calgary because they didn't have enough money, and they knew that they weren't going to get any more from the citizens.
Mm-hmm.
So they went ahead right away and put it up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was put up where it still is now.
Mm-hmm.
But Mother was the one who signed the big check from the IODE
to have it erected.
Yes, they would have liked to have a much bigger one, a much more elaborate one, but they thought while they were younger, they should have it up in their time. The Canadian Legion felt the same way about it.
Mm-hmm. I see, yeah. Of course, IODE was very active during the First War as well.
Yes, and the Second War.
And the Second War. That's to remember. It was only a little after a year we were living in Edmonton that World War One did break out.
Yes.
Can you remember?
Yes, we had gone. Perhaps the adults in the party knew about it, but the children didn't. And we had gone on August the 4th. It was a Monday, I think. of the White Sands. A group of us had rented something. It may have been a truck, but we all went out, and there was probably a big party, probably about 20 people. And we'd had a couple of very good meals there. And then when we came back, the boys were running down the street. War had been declared, and the men all grabbed the newspaper. Mm-hmm. And it was a different world from then on.
Mm-hmm. Was the attitude one of, almost excitement, or was it very negative? A lot of
apprehension. It was excitement. With apprehension and almost not triumphant, but almost jubilant. It was not negative in any way at all. It was something that had to be done. Some of the young men wondered if they'd even get overseas, where the war wouldn't be finished before they got back. There were a great many men, young men in Edmonton, who were attached to the British Army with probably a very, very small pension or emolument, who were to be recalled. And they went off in trainers, probably in train load. There were a great many who went off anyway.
Right away, yeah.
Right away, because they were called to the regiment.
Yeah.
I presume that the British government paid for them or got them home some way, but there seemed to be no delay or doubt. They just left. And then the young man in town, I think that was soon after that the Princess Pats was formed. It was called Princess Pats after Princess Patricia, who was the daughter of the Governor General at the time.
They left in droves as well.
They left in droves, yes.
Yeah. As the war progressed, there must have been a great deal of anti-German feeling in Edmonton that manifested itself in many ways.
Yes.
Do you recall any particular incident?
Well, one night Father and I were coming home from the Highlands. I'd been to a children's party. And we were coming down with a streetcar, my streetcar, and just before we got to 97th Street, which was then called the Mayo Avenue, the streetcar was stopped, and two soldiers got on. And we were told that the streetcar would not stop until it came to the Hudson's Bay at 103rd Street. And we wondered why, and I was just a little dubious that perhaps I'd seen a few, read too many spy books, or... And I wondered why. And as we passed each of the streets, Fraser Avenue, McDougall, First Street, and Second Street, the streets were all barricaded and soldiers standing there. And somebody on the bus told us that the soldiers in the barracks, realizing that the staff, the management of the McDonald's Hotel were German, they were going to go down and take the McDonald Hotel apart. I don't know what they were going to do with the staff. Probably chase them into the river. I don't know. And it was very, very exciting. And I went home all bubbling about it. My brother told me years later that he was very disappointed the next morning when he got up and looked out of the window, and there was the McDonald standing just as it had the night before. It hadn't been burnt out.
I see. I imagine some senior officers intervened somewhere along the way and stopped this. Yes. Well, that's quite something. The McDonald Hotel at this time, of course, was the most elegant, exquisite, grand hotel.
And people who see it now will never know what it was like. It was built like a chateau. Of course, it was called a chateau. And it was furnished the most beautiful, heavy furniture. A great many of the rooms have disappeared. as coming in the front door into the big hall. There was a room known as Confederation Room with the most magnificent picture of the Fathers of Confederation. It was an exact copy of the first picture that was painted, which was standing in, or hung, in the Parliament Buildings in Ottawa. And after the Parliament Buildings was burnt, they sent painters out to Edmonton to reproduce the picture, so that the one in Ottawa now is a copy of ours.
A copy of ours?
Ours is still there, but ours is a copy of the first one. And the one down there is a copy of ours. And I've seen it, and it's a very good one.
Uh-huh. Oh. Yeah.
Coming in on the main, to the left, with a rather quieter and unostentatious door, and it went right across the lobby with an elevator, and that door was built so that ladies who had to travel alone could enter and leave the hotel in obscurity and without being subjected to annoyance by other guests.
Isn't that right? Is that a common feature of hotels, or was this?
Well, I don't know.
Unique? I suppose it's probably unique to Edmonton.
I don't know. The reason I do know is that the McDonald Hotel had the brochure that was printed at that time, and I saw it about, say, 20 years ago. And I do hope that there's one copy left, I mean, to go into one of the archives. But I saw one copy there then, probably thrown away now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the McDonald, it seems to me, perhaps superseded the Alberta Hotel as the outstanding hotel in Edmonton.
Yeah, oh yes, it did. But there was no comparison. Even then there was no comparison.
No, not at all.
There was no comparison even then. It was something beyond the dreams of Edmontonians when it was built.
Right. Yes. But with the McDonald located where it is, and the Alberta where it is, this isn't far removed from the 97th Street area.
No.
What sort of area was 97th, 96th Street just north of Jasper at this time? Did it have the same reputation then it has now?
No.
Bit of a red light district?
There must have been a red light district, but I don't know where it would be. But the homes east of 97th Street were very nice homes, and they were well kept.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no stigma in living there at all. And if you go down, say, 95th Street, some of those streets, you'll still be surprised.
You do.
The nice houses.
Yes, I have.
And they're well kept.
Elegant houses there.
Yes, they're well kept. But the
The Chinese community in that area are very, very good at keeping their homes.
But there are still some nice houses there, and a great many people moved from there west. I knew a lady who used to tell stories of this, about the, well, that was the time, you know, we lived in a brick house in Clara Street.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was something. And I also knew another lady about that time who was a friend of Mother's, and she said, you know, when we lived in the prairie, my dear, when we first came, we lived in the prairie. And the prairie turned out to be about a block or two north of 118th Avenue, about 95th Street. But it was prairie.
Uh-huh.
But she always spoke of the time when we lived in the prairie, my dear.
Yeah. In 1913, when you came, another building that was being completed was the Pantages Theater.
Well, that was up.
It was up.
I think it was.
Uh-huh.
Because I have no recollection of it opening or any change on the street. So it must have been probably started in 13 and in 12 and finished in 13.
Nearly 13.
Because it seemed to me it was operating then.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall the early Pantages or some of the vaudeville?
Oh,
events,
no.
Like that?
Children of our cast didn't go to vaudeville.
Oh, I see.
No.
It was strictly a very popular
oh, yes.
sort of place.
Oh, yes, it was. And apparently they had some very, very good programs.
Oh, yes.
But children didn't go.
Harry Lauder.
Yes.
But
children didn't go. And then, of course, there was the real theater on 3rd Street. The Empire.
The Empire. Uh-huh. Well, that is the, that is preserved today, I believe. The Truck.
The Truck is part of it. Truck Hill.
Yeah.
But the first, there was an Empire just north of the lane. And then the new Empire was built about half a block north. And that was a very elegant theater.
Uh-huh.
And across the street, on 3rd Street, just about half a block north of Jasper, where the would be at the back of People's Credit Bureau. It was the Lyceum, and that had some very good plays on, I think.
Mm-hmm. It was a very strong dramatic.
A very strong dramatic.
Movement in that.
Yeah.
You attended these theaters?
When things were fit and proper to take children, we went. Otherwise, we didn't go.
I see, yeah. Well, I imagine a lot of your social activity in these years was centered around the church. What church did you attend?
We were Anglicans. We went to All Saints Cathedral, or Pro Cathedral it was.
Mm-hmm.
And it was known as the Church of England. And then it became the Anglican Church of Canada. And then during the war, they started calling it the Episcopalian Church. And I resented that. I wasn't going
American
to be changed again. But that was what it was. But strangely enough, most of my friends were Presbyterians.
Okay.
Their church was across on the corner of 3rd and Jasper. But they had just built the big edifice on 5th Street. And All Saints had bought some land south of the street between Mackay Avenue and Victoria Avenue. But we never built because we never had the money.
Mm-hmm.
But most of my friends when I went to school were Anglicans, were Presbyterians, although I had some Anglican friends.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, in these years, you began going to Mackay Avenue School. Did you continue in the school?
I went to Mackay until I was through grade 8.
Uh-huh.
I went to McDougall School for 1 year because there were no grade 9s at Victoria at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went to Victoria and I finished my education there.
I see. Once this was completed, did you take employment? Or?
No, I went to normal school.
School.
But I decided I wasn't going to like teaching.
Uh-huh.
So then I took a business course and started working with the government.
I see, yes. What was the education system like in these early days? Was it much specialization? I know there is such a variety of subjects that students are required to be exposed to today, but was it instead the basic reading, writing, arithmetic?
Grammar, composition, history, geography, and they were all, as far as I'm concerned, they were all well taught.
Mm-hmm. They were very high standards.
The standards were very high.
Uh-huh.
And we had some very excellent teachers at Mackay. Percy Ribbaney was the principal. And Miss Batchelor, Miss Draper, and Miss Berger. Those are the ones that stand out.
Mm-hmm.
The very pretty one in grade 3, Miss Patterson, would come from Nova Scotia. She had blonde hair and she kept it beautiful, beautifully dressed.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a Miss Smith who was the fear of everybody. He was very strict.
Among your school friends, were there any that later rose to prominence in public life? Did you know what?
Lotta Dempsey was one of them.
Uh-huh.
And she, as you know, became a very famous journalist. But most of the others really stayed around. Not most of them, but a great many of them did stay around. There were judges went at the same time I was, prominent lawyers, prominent doctors, men who went into Presbyterian and Anglican churches. We thought once that if we got all the people who'd been to Mackay, if we'd had a Mackay reunion, we'd have had at least 70% of the prominent people in Edmonton.
I see, yes. So a great deal of them.
Well, it was the area around there, you see, that they were likely to be successful in whatever they did.
Yeah. Were you associated at all with the university at this time, or did you know any of the individuals that were at the university?
Well, both my brothers did, and Mother was she wasn't a graduate there. She was a graduate of the Royal Academy of London.
Uh-huh.
But she was always being called upon for things or to do things, and she and Father were usually invited to big functions. And then, of course, my brothers went, and I got to know a great many people at that time. And at that time, you knew every professor
uh-huh.
and what he did. Nowadays, I don't suppose they know half of them. It was a small university, and who was it? Dr. Torrey. Dr. Torrey was the first,
uh-huh.
and he wanted to get the best men he could in the country. And I believe his approach was to them, I can't pay you very much, but I can give you a good standard of living and plenty of time for research. Dr. Kahn was one of them. A man named Boyle. Boyle was a physicist, I think. Anyway, he took a couple of his students a couple of years across the Atlantic, and they were doing some research work on the ship. And I've forgotten what it was, but that was what they did.
I see,
yeah. And Corbett, who worked with Corbett and Banting on insulin.
He did
a lot of his research there.
He did, huh? Yeah. And you knew these individuals?
Oh, yes.
Did you know Dr. Torrey?
Yes.
Uh-huh. What sort of man was Dr. Torrey?
Well, I think I was a little in awe of him.
Oh, I imagine many people were.
I think most people were. Yeah. I knew Dr. Alexander better. And I don't know why. I knew the Broaddusses. And I knew some of the mathematicians. I can't remember who he was now. But I knew those. But they were Southside people. And they were university people.
That's right.
They had a social circle of their own, as most of the Southside people had.
Well, that's right. That's one thing I've noticed in the Strathcona Plain Dealer, that news of the north side of the river, well, this is prior to amalgamation, mind you, but even then, it was very scanty. Yeah.
It wasn't of any interest to them. And we can say to somebody, meet them out, and a group of Edmontonians away, when somebody's mentioned, and I'd say, Well, you know, I really don't know her because, you see, she was outside.
Uh-huh.
She left before...
The amalgamation itself didn't really bring that much.
No, it didn't.
A gradual thing coming together, yeah. At this time, though, on the north side, there were three newspapers doing a very good business. The Capital, the Journal, and the Bulletin.
Of course, yes.
Well, what, did you get more than one paper, your family? Or did you concentrate on one pretty well?
I think we got the three of them. One was a morning paper.
Uh-huh.
I think one was a morning paper. And one was a noon paper, and then the journal was a later paper. I think that was what it was. But I remember seeing them in the house, and the Capital had red headlines.
Yes, and I believe more photographs.
And more photographs, yeah.
I don't suppose you recall whether you were relatively young before the Capital went under, so you don't recall too much about the paper, the editorial policy,
no,
or anything of that.
No, and I didn't know the policy of the other two. I knew the Bulletin was a liberal paper.
Yeah, it has been Frank.
And the Journal was a conservative paper.
Uh-huh.
And I think the Bulletin was a bigger paper.
Right.
Journal, I think, was the second paper.
Well, with the coming of war and a recession in Edmonton, and during the 20s, I think Edmonton did emerge a little bit from the feeling of doom. Can you detect any change in social climate in the city from the 20s perhaps didn't hit Edmonton as drastically as it did the American cities?
No, we didn't feel much of the Depression until the 30s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think I should tell you before I forget. On the 1st of January, New Year's Day, the ladies stayed home and the gentlemen went calling. And they went calling on the Governor General, or Lieutenant Governor, Dr. McQueen, Bishop Gray, the mayor, or the wives, really, of these people. And it was quite exciting.
This was their first footing, I believe.
Their first footing, and I think probably it was whether it was Scottish or whether it was partly French, I don't know. But the men would go off quite glee, you know, in the afternoon, and goodness knows when they would turn up.
Uh-huh.
Well, all the military establishments, any man who had any connection with the military went there. They usually went to the lieutenant governors first, and then they went to the military, and then if they had any reason, they went to the RCMP.
Uh-huh.
And on the way, they might stop at the bishops or the mayors or the person to the university.
Uh-huh.
And then the time would come when one of the boys in the family would be old enough to drive, and he would drive the father and his other friends, and they'd sit in the car outside while the men were inside. And then came the big day when the boy was old enough to go in. And that was a very exciting day. And he would go, he'd be well primed as what he was to do and how he was to stand and what he was to say. And then they would go in. And my brother was taken, and years later he did the same thing into his son, to Government House, and then to some of the armies, and then sent him home.
Was New Year's and Christmas at this time celebrated with as much consumption of alcohol as it has been?
Well, I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know. Because we always had a certain amount in the family, but it was always kept under control.
Uh-huh.
I remember the time of Prohibition, when you couldn't buy it in Edmonton, but it could be brought in, couldn't be bought in the pardon, but you could get it from a wholesaler or a warehouse in probably Regina, and it would come up and it in the square wooden box, like a doll's box, the box that you bought new dolls in. Very uncompromising. He just couldn't hide it, wooden box, and they had to be picked up. And very often the ladies in the family had to go and do this because the men wouldn't have time and they couldn't leave their businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And they would try and hide it with scarves, or they'd try and put it in their muff,
mm-hmm.
or carry a fur on it, but you knew perfectly well what it was.
Yeah. Yeah.
And about that time, the Hudson's Bay and Johnson Walters and Ramsey's were the three big stores, and everybody shopped there. And the ladies in that area used to walk uptown with the dogs. Everybody had a dog, it seemed to me, and everybody's dog went.
Yeah.
And somebody would say, I wonder about Mrs. Brown, you know, I haven't seen Patty. I haven't even seen Patty uptown for a while. Or I'd meet somebody and they'd say, your mother must be uptown because I saw your dog Togo facing that Afghanistan he doesn't like. And kept track of each other that way.
That's something like the situation exists in Britain today.
Yes.
A lot of dogs, I know I stayed in Yorkshire, and they're very fond of their dogs. Well, as you went to normal school, but you decided not to go into teaching. So did you take employment shortly afterwards?
I worked for the provincial government.
Uh-huh. And you worked for them for a number of years?
I worked them all my working life.
Uh-huh. What form of employment did you take?
I started as a stenographer, and then I became an inspector years later. Because they wouldn't have inspectors under 30 in those days. And I did that for the rest of my life, but the latter years, it was mostly office work that I was doing.
Uh-huh.
Watching files,
uh-huh.
watching what the men were doing, that type of thing.
Uh-huh. Now, you began working when the UFA government...
They'd just gone in.
I see. But they're... UFA was essentially a farmer's government.
Yes.
And was there much animosity towards that fact from the city people in Edmonton?
I don't know that there was. Soon after they were in power and established, the citizens of Edmonton decided to have a dinner for them, and the heads of all big city organizations were invited to this dinner. They were giving it for the government, and if a wife had a prominent position in an organization, she was invited, but the husband wasn't, and the husband had a prominent position in another organization. He was invited, but the wives weren't invited. But the wives and members of the government were all invited to this. It took place in the mayor. And they were, I've forgotten who the mayor was at the time, but they were greeted. It was a very happy affair, I think. Mother was there, because I think at that time she was vice president of the Women's Canadian Club. But it was something of that kind.
Uh-huh.
So there was no animosity, I don't think. No.
The mayor, Mr. Joe Clark at the time, so...
I can't remember.
Yeah. Did you know Joe Clark, or recall?
I remember Mrs. Clark.
Oh, you knew Mrs. Clark.
I knew Mrs. Clark and both the girls.
Mm-hmm. But not... Those were an expense.
No, because children didn't know the fathers of people of, unless there was a strong family relationship. Mother and father knew him, and they knew Bradford too.
Mm-hmm.
But they, I didn't know Joe Clark. I remember seeing him, a big, busty man. But just that's all. I didn't know him as anything.
I see, yeah. Well, periodically, throughout your life in Edmonton, you were exposed to a number of royal visits.
Yes.
Royal visits here, occasionally Earl Grey and various kings. Do you recall the royal visits and the feeling towards the royal visits that was so strong in Edmonton?
The first one I remember was the visit of the Prince of Wales, who later became the Duke of Windsor.
Uh-huh.
He came in September, beginning of the school year, and we were all taken down to the Parliament buildings to see him. When he had been in the East, He had shaken hands with all the school children, but by this time his arm had given out, so he just stood and we stood there. And I automatically curtsied to him, and everybody thought it was such a surprise. And I had no intention of doing that; I wasn't thinking of it. But when I got to him, I went down, right down. And then he came back some years later with his brother.
Uh-huh.
But I think I was at the lake at that time. And when I was moving, I came across an invitation to Government House, which was sent to my brothers when the son of one of the lieutenant governor generals was coming to town, and was a dancer at the Government House. And these two boys were invited.
When King George V came, that would be in the '20s, I believe. He stayed, if I'm not mistaken, in the Corona Hotel.
Oh, I don't remember that.
Yeah.
Not the McDonald's?
I believe it was the Corona, which was built on the site of the old Corona, which had burned down.
Yes.
And it was very new at this time. I understand he was staying there. I understand that the Corona was a very exquisite hotel.
It was very comfortable, well-managed hotel, and a great many widowers lived there. Their lounge was unbelievable. You came in through the door and it was beautifully furnished. There were always flowers. There was a long table in the center and a great big fireplace and very comfortable chairs. And I had my little nieces out one day and I took them in to see the Christmas tree. And I was talking to a friend who lived there, Miss Chappelle, and the bellboy, came in to light, to build up the fire. And these two little girls, one in pale blue and the other one in pink, knelt by him like a pair of little acolytes. And he was building them. And one said to me, "He's putting on black stones and he says they're going to burn." So we waited long enough to let the coals take light. That was one of the highlights in that place, because at that time they lived in a house that had no fireplace.
Uh-huh. I see. Wow.
And Sunday dinner was a must. Practically everybody went to the Corona Sunday dinner.
Uh-huh.
And it was beautifully served. And the meal was excellent. And you met all your friends, and you had the chance of sitting around in this lovely lounge. And and during the evening.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is something that changed a bit today, I guess.
It has.
Well, indeed, a lot of everything has changed. Do you have any opinions on the nature of architectural change in Edmonton and redevelopment? And what has been destroyed? What has been replaced?
Well, I'm not very happy with all the changes, but then I said, a place has to grow, and people say, well, look at the lovely things in London. Well, but they, the Georgian buildings, too, were replacing old brick houses, so it's just the same. Maybe the generation 100 years from now thinks we've made very good changes. But there are some other things that are not quite as good. Now, when we came, we had mail delivery in residential areas twice a day, 6 days a week.
Twice a day, six days a week. That has certainly changed.
Now.
Yeah.
And the first winter, I was very impressed with a little wooden snowplow. It was made of wood. It was probably made in their own maintenance shop. But it was just like the big snowplows. And it had a horse and a man with two handles. And the horse and the snowplow and the man went down all the residential streets after a snowstorm.
Mm, I see.
Now that's something we've missed.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah.
That even probably came down the hill into ours. Down the hill.
Yeah, that has changed today. I guess there's a lot, far greater feeling of civic, a feeling of community, a sense of community
yes.
this time as well.
And nobody would have dared walk on a boulevard or throw anything on the street.
Uh-huh.
Might be a mud street, but you never threw anything on it or threw it on the boulevard.
Uh-huh.
So there were all those beautiful boulevards in the old part of the town,
uh-huh.
and they were cherished. People
uh-huh.
were proud of them.
Uh-huh. It seems to me that Edmonton has seen such a great population shuffle, so shall we say, that we have actually very little sense of heritage, you know, comparatively speaking, to other cities in particular and Europe. But one
well, of course, all Canadian cities are new like that,
uh-huh.
overall. Although, perhaps Edmonton is older than the others because it had the Hudson's Bay Fort. I presume it's older than Calgary because they had no Hudson Bay Fort really.
Right, yeah. But the city proper, as it grew up between, say, the turn of the century and 1913, that one decade and a half, pretty well, saw so much being built, and consequently there was a sense of uniformity in
yes.
architecture, whereas today you have one hodgepodge of designs
yes.
and styles. So that is unfortunate. When did you yourself start to become interested in history? You've done considerable work for the Historical Society in the Edmonton Archives.
I was on the city archives for 7 years, which is the limit,
uh-huh.
and I was then on the Names Advisory Committee for 7 years, which is again a limit.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. We had a cottage at Cooking Lake, and we went out for the full 2 months, and we stayed. There was no running backwards and forwards. When we got to the lake, we stayed for the whole 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
And most of it was South Cooking Lake, which was one of the early camping sites for the city, and many of the people were old-timers, and they used to tell stories of the early days.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes disreputable.
Mm-hmm.
But something that was very interesting. Well, I think perhaps that sparked it, because I've always been interested in the beginnings and what happened.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, you've certainly had a great deal to tell us in this interview. I'm certain it's going to be of great use to social historians and researchers in times to come, so I'd like to thank you very much on behalf of the City Archives.
Something else.
Oh, well, yes.
Something else I should have told you. east, Jasper Avenue east of what is now 100th Street, which is then McDougal. There were a lot of small, dingy shops. They were manufacturing jewelers. And they used to have signs in the window. 4 and 5 all the way down the street. Marriage licenses sold here.
Is that right?
So I suppose when you went to buy the ring, you bought your marriage license.
You bought your marriage license at the
same time.
Another thing,
one stop does it all.
Yeah.
And then later on, after the oil boom, 1914, in Turner Valley, they had little, they were selling real estate and they were selling oil stock. And many of them had little tiny oil derricks, about 6 or 9 inches high, that were supposed to be working. And they were the Black Diamond or Monaca and all the other oil wells. And you could buy oil stock all the way down the street.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Something as well. Do you remember very well the oil boom of 45, 46, and how the atmosphere of the town changed as a result? Or is it that unique?
My father was getting to be an old man, a very alert old man. And I remember my brother coming in, my brother Winfield coming in, fairly late in the evening, and he said, "Tom," we call Father Tom. "Tom," he said, "they found oil in the Duke today. It's a sure thing." And he said, "It's going to change the nature of the province entirely." Winslow was a very prominent businessman.
Uh-huh.
He was the, I understand that he was the taxation expert across Canada, and whenever they wanted some very, very technical information in court, he was very often called to go down to Toronto and Montreal. He was a partner with Winsby and Hamilton.
I see. Yeah. Well, I'd like to thank you again for the very interesting interview with Hamilton. I'm sure going to be of great use to future.
Well, I hope it is.
This material is a digitized audio recording from the holdings of the City of Edmonton Archives. For more information regarding the recording, please contact us by email at cms.archives@edmonton.ca, by phone at 780-496-8711, or on our online catalog at cityarchives.edmonton.ca.